So my name is Blair White, and I'll be moderating the session. This is session 276, titled Bisexuality and Mormonism. Before we begin, we ask that all cell phones are turned off and that those attending will be respectful and attentive. It is the mission of Sunstone to host thoughtful and respectful dialogue. We invite all here to practice looking at all Mormon experiences as legitimate Mormon experiences, no matter how diverse they may be. This session is being recorded, and you will be able to purchase it after the presentation ends at the registration desk on the main floor. We also hope, after taking time to purchase goods from vendors, including booksellers like Benchmark Books, please support Mormon Studies by supporting our vendors. This session is 90 minutes long, maybe. And we ask both audience and presenters to keep within the framework. After this session, many attendees are gathering at the local Crown Burger, a Utah tradition. Please return on time for our plenary with Linda K. Klein, who will be speaking on the parallels between the evangelical and Mormon purity movements. Seats will fill up quickly. About this presentation. This session will explore the experience of bisexual people in Mormonism. Where in the framework of Mormonism do bisexual people fit? What additional challenges exist within Mormonism versus outside of Mormonism for bisexual people? How does being bisexual impact one's faith and belief? Nicholas R. Stewart grew up in the Mormon Church, got married in the Los Angeles Temple, and served in the four elders' quorum presidencies. He is no longer an active, believing member of the Mormon Church. Active in transitioning ex- and post-Mormon social media groups, Nicholas is a fan of forums like Sunstone, where people can share their stories and experiences. Nicholas has a Master of Urban Planning and a Bachelor of Arts in American History. Originally from California, Nicholas and his wife now reside in Baltimore, where he works as a transit planner.
And eat good crab cakes.
Blair Osler is a philosopher and leading voice on the intersection of queer, Mormon, and transhumanist thought. She is a board member and former CEO of the Mormon Transhumanist Association, the world's largest advocacy network for the ethical use of technology and religion to expand human abilities. She presents and writes on many forums and speaks at conferences promoting authentic Mormonism. Blair holds a degree in design from the International Academy of Design and Technology in Seattle. She is currently pursuing a second degree in philosophy.
Graduated. Never mind. Scratch that. Sorry, totally rude.
She has graduated with a degree in philosophy and with an emphasis in gender studies. Mm-hmm. She is also an artist and spends her spare time hiking, painting, writing, and bickering with her friends about almost any topic imaginable. Blair and her husband, Drew, reside in Utah with their three children.
Thank you. Should we introduce ourselves really fast? Okay. So one of the things, so this is nice that we have a smaller group. I kind of love talking with smaller groups more than bigger groups, because then I don't get to talk at you, and I feel like we can talk with each other. And just briefly, as the show of hands, I want to know what made you pick this session. And don't be afraid to be totally honest. You're like, I walked by and the door was open, so I walked in. But what was it that you were looking for in this experience? What was it that piqued your curiosity? Anyone? Yeah, no. Okay, we'll go. Okay, so just to learn something new and interesting, to have your mind blown, basically.
Blair, I need to interrupt. This is a recorded session, so everyone will need to use a microphone. I'm happy to bring it to you.
Okay, my bad. You go ahead.
Nicholas is my son, and I always want to learn more.
That's as far as it goes.
I have a roommate who recently came out as bisexual, and we've talked about a lot of aspects of her journey, where she's at, and where, you know, the aspects that are still really confusing to her. So just want to learn more and kind of be a supportive friend.
Awesome.
Well, halfway I'm here because I started talking to two friends and we just kept going until they closed the door. But the other half is that the handful of people I know who would say they're bisexual and would say is an important characteristic, self-identification in that way. But with them, there is this question that I want to explore, or hear you explore, that it is possible to take the church's direction to marry heterosexually, to date that way, and to think I can make that work. And I'm interested in the way those pressures operate and work and push people to make choices that are not in the middle, or whatever the right way to say that is, but push people to make themselves select. There you go.
Yeah, no, I feel you. I feel you. I know what you're talking about.
Good.
Oh, okay.
I have a bisexual son who has nothing to do with the church anymore, but I want to understand him a little better since he was raised Mormon. And I'm certain that he won't be the last bisexual person I encounter in the church. And I want to make sure that I'm at least trying to learn how to be a decent ally and a supporting voice.
Awesome. All right.
Sure. I love how everyone's talking about how they're going to meet more bisexual people and, like, the handful of bisexual people, you know. I identify as a bisexual Mormon.
Yes.
And
welcome.
Thank you. I feel so welcomed, and I love that people are here. And my mother now identifies as bisexual after, which is something I learned relatively recently, and is very much still in the church. Yeah, self-identification, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm currently a prospective missionary for the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, and as a teen, I'm currently struggling with my sexuality in a predominantly Orthodox Mormon household. So came to this presentation to hopefully kind of quell some of those feelings of fear. My dad left the church a few years ago, and so I don't feel uncomfortable talking to him. But my mom, even though she does have a gay brother and her entire family is very supportive of that, I just have a bit of fear of just coming out to the family and seeing if that will change their perspective of me.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Else? All right, one more.
I think everybody else really spoke my reasonings here, but I think you're phenomenal. I love your boldness, and it's been very helpful. And as a therapist, I think working with this population, it's very important for me to explore anything I potentially don't know so that I'm practicing safely and encouraging in this environment in a way that's healthy and encouraging.
Awesome. So. Okay, cool. All right, so we got some good things going on here. This is great. So two of the things we're going to talk about today really is one is kind of like, what are the challenges? And that's kind of what I wrote about, and it actually turned out to be really, really sad. And I was like, oh, I don't want to end on totally a sad note. But the good news is there's, I don't want to say light at the end of the rainbow. Let's put it that way. There are some more hopeful aspects, too, that I'd love for us to talk about it afterwards. For those of you who don't know, I'm publishing my first book, Queer Mormon Theology, and it basically... Oh, thank you, Nick. It basically deals with a lot of these issues. Where do queer people fit in Mormon theology, and how do we reimagine and re-put the pieces together to have a more inclusive theology? For... the first part of it, the thing that I wrote that I'd like to share with you is outlining some of the like the severity of what it can be like being queer and Mormon at the same time. And you'll have to forgive me. I use the word queer in place of bisexual, or I use them interchangeably most of the time. Queer also encompasses my gender identity, so I'll use queer or bisexual just so you know what I'm talking about. A lot of people don't know, but in the queer community, bisexuals have the highest rates of, after the trans community, have the highest rates of suicide ideation and depression and anxiety. And a lot of that has to do with bi erasure. And what I have written here that I want to share with you is how these intersections of just plain old good old-fashioned sexism and how the bisexual experience can cause these kind of triggering effects for people that causes these kind of stresses on the bi community. But after we get through that, I do want to talk about happy things. Do you want to say anything before I jump into it? Yeah.
So I'm actually going to answer Blair's question about why we're here, you know, like why I'm here. I'm here because I'm crazy enough to organize a session about this. I did this session because this is my fourth year at Sunstone, and there's been a lot of LGBT general, you know, sessions. And that's great, but as someone who is bi, and as Blair said, bi erasure is a thing, I think it's important for me and for other bisexual people to have a session that has bisexual in it outright, because things are, and it's not that you know, it's a better or worse or special treatment kind of thing, but not all of the letters in the LGBTQ+ experience is not all the same. And I think often they get kind of lumped together under the assumption that that alphabet soup just kind of all experiences all the same sorts of problems the same way. And that's just not the case. So that's why I organized the session. And you're going to hear a lot from Blair, because Blair's got a lot more actual stuff to talk about than I really do. But I'm going to be the happy one at the end. So I think we'll even out okay in the end.
That was perfect. I love everything you just said. Okay. Let's go ahead and get started. You'll have to forgive me for reading to you. This is pretty raw. So if any of it, as you were saying, like, my style is very direct. It's very vulnerable. It's very unapologetic. So if I ever come off as maybe too aggressive or brash, it's because I am. So just keep your thick skin on, and know if you dish it right back to me, that's okay. We can have a dialogue about it, okay? Mine mostly talks about... I spent a year in therapy for suicide ideation, and I wrote something to hopefully provide clarity and understanding and put words to an experience so people can understand why. And so often it is the case that people are like, I don't understand why. Well, this is why. It's going to be sad, but we'll get to the good parts too. All right. More studies come out every year with new findings concerning anxiety, depression, and suicide rates of LGBTQ folks. More often than not, I'm tired of the statistics. I'm tired of listening to others debate our suicide ideation attempts and reasons. I'm tired of listening to inaccurate assumptions, bad stereotypes, and ignorant comments. But more than anything, I'm tired of burying my friends. Of all sexual orientations, the bisexual population experiences the highest rates of depression, anxiety, and suicidal thoughts. Bisexual females exhibited the highest suicide scores, with bisexual girls at the most vulnerable, with nearly 48% saying they had considered taking their own lives. Much of this is due to victimization, peer judgments, biphobia, and family rejection. Pew Research Center shows that... bisexuals are significantly less likely to disclose their sexual orientation to their family and friends than their monosexual peers. Only about 28% of bisexuals say all or most of the important people in their life know they are bisexual. By comparison, 70 to 80% of gays and lesbians participated say that all or most of the important people in their life know they are homosexual. One recent study found that bisexual people in same-sex relationships fared better off than those in heterosexual relationships. Bisexuals in heterosexual relationships reported significantly poorer mental health. This research challenges long-held beliefs and assumptions that bisexuals in heterosexual relationships are protected from protected due to bi privilege, passing privilege, or also called passing privilege. It means when someone looks at you, they assume that you're just straight. It's one thing to study the statistics, and it's quite another to be the statistics. The statistics are important, but they don't tell the whole story. And I am a whole person with a story to tell. And I won't let the statistics speak on my behalf. It's just not my style. As mentioned, I spent a year in therapy for suicide ideation, and what started as unwelcome dreams turned into constant ideation at home, at school, at work, at church. At my lowest, there were times when I couldn't even leave my room other than to feed my children. The things that brought me joy no longer brought me joy, and the smallest details and comments could be triggering. This is mostly directed towards bisexual women, but I also want to acknowledge that there is a lot of overlap between the experiences of bisexual men and bisexual women and other members of the LGBTQ community. Some women maybe even identify with some of these things, even though they're not bisexual. And I suspect that there will be other racial minorities and people who would struggle with these issues too, so I don't necessarily suggest that my experience is the only experience that is experiencing these kinds of things. So I've compiled a list, bullet points, of some things that are what are most triggering for anxiety, depression, and suicide ideation. And I'm guessing there are a lot of bisexual people who feel similarly too. And hopefully in the expression of these issues, it will offer education and understanding, and I hope for a world where we change these tragic statistics and that these are just relics of the past. So the first point is media. Representation matters. It's trite, but it's true. I remember watching one of my favorite shows, Westworld, and one of the villains in the show, there was a very sexually explicit scene where he's having sex with both a man and a woman, and he was portrayed as a promiscuous bisexual. And so the one villain in the show had to be the bisexual. The main character wasn't the bisexual. The protagonist, the blonde, beautiful white woman, the protagonist, she was, of course, heterosexual, monogamous, and all the things that she should be. And it followed that because our sexual orientation, the justification it seems like in the media is that because our sexual orientations aren't exclusive to one gender, that we're not exclusive or thoughtful in anything or any of our sexual partners. It's as if that his character portrayed bisexuals as only interested in sex and nothing else mattered. Just because your gender doesn't matter doesn't mean other things don't matter to us. It's as if sometimes we don't have feelings or romantic interests, or that we're impure and selfish, and above all, you know, it's as if we're portrayed as promiscuous and untrustworthy. Apparently not having gender boundaries is tantamount to not having any boundaries at all, even if that means consent can't even be taken seriously because we're always presumed as ready and wanting sex. I knew these things, but even still I was taken off guard with this character because his bisexuality had literally nothing to do with his character. The portrayal of his bisexuality was just an extension of his lack of empathy and morals for other people, and bisexuality seemed like a great twist on that. The portrayal of his bisexuality, it was entirely unnecessary. The next point is what's called passing privilege. Passing privilege is the idea that when people interact with you on a regular basis, they assume you're either homosexual or heterosexual, and heterosexual being the more privileged of the two. But passing privilege is kind of like trans passing privilege, like passing for cisgender, is a two-edged sword. Passing privilege also comes with erasure. If I pass as straight, then my authentic bisexual experience gets erased. Bi erasure is the neglect, removal, or falsification of bisexual experiences. bisexuality comes with the trauma of being homosexual, but with the bonus of being told that because you have hetero passing privilege, your trauma isn't worth acknowledging or treatment. Passing also seems to imply that I'm getting away with something, that bisexuals are being dishonest in the way we represent ourselves. Passing is a verb that I'm doing something to deceive you of my sexual orientation. To compensate for this, sometimes in an effort to be completely honest, bisexuals become overt about sharing their bisexual orientation. However, this can come off as being hypersexual. This puts bisexuals in a double bind where we're either being too sexually overt about our orientation or dishonest and trying to hide something from the people in our lives. So we have to learn how to walk the tightrope of impossible social expectations of being the right kind of bisexual. So it's no wonder that bisexuals like myself would suffer from social anxiety, because you're damned if you do and damned if you don't. You're either constantly worried about being found out or constantly being worried about being perceived as like a hypersexualized maniac. So every social situation puts you in a situation where you're either too honest or dishonest. The reality is, passing privilege is not my privilege. It is my bi erasure. At least that's how I experience it. It's emotionally exhausting sometimes being around monosexuals, so much so that I'll seek friendships exclusively with bisexual people, just because you don't have to constantly explain who you are and justify your existence in the world. It's for reasons like these I tend to have a close handful of exclusively close friends. It's quite humorous, though, actually, because bisexuals are often accused of being promiscuous, untrustworthy, and noncommittal. But yet when it comes to my friendships and my intimate relationships, I'm quite exclusive and quite loyal and quite committed. The next bullet point is friendships. Friendships can sometimes be really difficult. This is not exclusive to bisexual women, but it is definitely worth mentioning. I can't tell you how many friends I've lost over the years due to being open about being queer, open about being bisexual. So many of these things were never problems for me when no one knew I was bisexual. But all of a sudden, once I was bisexual, it was this new and totally different experience. So just because somebody comes out as bisexual doesn't give them, you know, a pass on the things that are experienced by homosexuals when they come out as well. Most of the friendships I lost, they were active LDS Mormons, and when I did come out, I was actually released from my calling, and I could no longer work with the youth or primary anymore. And so it was really difficult to have friendships I had had for years to be my ward's primary president and to be in the young women's presidency and to go to girls' camp and all these things, and then to come out and have these friendships literally ripped from you by simply coming out. So I would not say that my experience was a positive experience. And luckily, that's changing. You know, it's definitely changing more so. And I think there's a difference between youth who come out, too. I think there's a little more, I hope, a little more compassion and care being extended to the youth. However, it doesn't change the fact that it hurts deeply to lose friends you've had for years just for coming out as bi. So the next point is sexual assault and consent. A lot of people don't know this, but according to findings in the Victimization and Sexual Orientation Survey, that in comparison to heterosexual women, bisexual women are twice as likely to experience sexual assault and three times as likely to be raped. Bisexual women have a 46.1% chance of being forcibly raped. This rate is 2.6 times higher than straight women and 3.5 times higher than lesbian women. Bisexual women share a harmful stereotype with women of color and male victims of sexual assault. Both seem to be perceived as always wanting sex. Therefore, sexual assault against us isn't taken seriously. Our consent isn't important because it's always implicitly given when you're bi. Sadly, she's the person most likely to experience sexual assault, but then is also treated as the least trustworthy. It's not difficult to understand why many bisexual women will be even reluctant to even report their assault. And when they do, surveys have shown that bisexual women receive the fewest positive social interactions of all and have the highest rates of post-traumatic stress disorder. So it's one thing to be assaulted and raped, and then it's quite another to be assaulted and raped and then told you were you deserved it, and then to not be believed, because if there's anything that's not believable, it's a woman. And even more unbelievable than that is a bi woman. So that's a big problem that needs to be addressed. The next bullet point is never queer enough. And this isn't exclusive to bi women at all. Well, neither is sexual assault either. Bisexuals are often perceived as not being queer enough. They can't be taken seriously by the either community because they certainly don't experience legitimate oppression and rejection. Bisexuals are kind of only half queer. The half queer premise assumes that heterosexuality and homosexuality are mutually exclusive categories. A person can't be both at the same time. But even more importantly, I think a person can be both at the same time and wholly both at the same time. And what I mean by wholly both is that bisexuals aren't having a partial experience. We're experiencing multiple things at the same time. We're having a heterosexual experience and a homosexual experience. It's not the mutually exclusive categories that people want to pit them out to be. So, for example, I don't consider myself half straight and half gay. This assumption sometimes causes a lot of stress because it assumes that we don't fully belong in either category. But we do have a whole experience. And this is why bisexuals are considered never gay enough or never straight enough. It's as if our orientation excludes us from full fellowship. Our heteropassing privilege keeps us feeling just guilty enough, though, to keep us refraining from talking about the trauma of internalized homophobia, biphobia, and monosexism. So it's no wonder that bisexuals would suffer from anxiety, depression, and suicide ideation more than any other orientation. We bear the burden of biphobia, homophobia, oppositional sexism, monosexism, women misogyny, and traditional sexism. And then on top of that, because some of us are attracted to trans and non-binary folks and intersex folks, we aren't trusted as taken seriously in our own orientation because it doesn't include your preferred gender. For the record, I'm wholly straight and wholly gay, which makes me wholly bisexual. The next bullet point is sexual fluidity. So I'm not certain where this attitude came from, but there's a notion that sexuality is fixed and that you are born that way and always that way. And while that might be true for the far majority of the population, I don't think that's true for everyone, especially it's not true for me. And I think bisexualities probably are prone to more fluidity than any other orientation. So while I understand why the Born That Way campaign has been helpful in furthering LGBTQ rights and acceptance, it doesn't tell the whole story of sexuality either. So while I don't think sexual orientation is something someone consciously chooses, and I'm not a proponent of conversion therapy, what I am saying is that sexual fluidity is a thing, and it's okay if it fluctuates, changes, and adapts over time. And this is especially common among bisexuals. There have been times in my life where I thought I was exclusively homosexual, and there were other times I thought I was exclusively heterosexual. During these times, I wasn't confused about what I wanted sexually. There's like this assumption that because it changes, you're confused. And I wasn't confused. I simply changed. My wants simply changed. Just because I want chocolate cake one night and I want ice cream another night doesn't mean I'm confused about what I want. I just wanted something different. Now, that doesn't mean I always get what I want either, you know. I mean, if we're going with analogy, I don't always get what I want. Yet for some reason, sexually fluid bisexuals are accused of being confused or illegitimate because there's this attitude that strict fix monosexuality works for most of the population, that it's going to work for all of the population. So our wants change over time, and it may change from one day to the next, but that in no way makes someone's orientation or experience illegitimate. The next point is plain good old-fashioned sexism. It's obviously not exclusive to bisexual women, but women in general, and that intersects at the bisexual experience to where bisexual women do experience massive amounts of sexism, misogyny, objectification, especially in pornography. And I'm not like trying to harp on the anti-pornography, you know, horn or anything like that, but I am saying that there is clear sexual objectification of the bisexual female, of being strictly an object of desire that can literally be used and then discarded. So sexism, the biggest point, though, the thing that has caused me the most stress in my life, and again, I wanted to say that a lot of these didn't bother me when I was not open about my sexual orientation. It wasn't until I did come out that these things did become problematic, and that these experiences, in some ways, like, and I don't want to tell anyone to stay in the closet, because, you know, it, to each their own, but there are definitely some perks sometimes to staying in the closet, because people just assume things, and you just let them assume wrong things, and you carry on with your daily life, although that's a big burden, too. So I don't want to say one is better than the other. Forget it. They both suck. Okay. The point, I'm like, forget it. It's just the worst. We're all going to die. No. The biggest point I wanted to bring up, the hardest thing for me, was religion and theology. And it wasn't just a problem with my church. It was a problem with the actual theology. I couldn't see where I fit. I didn't see any way that I was going to be able to make this work. So I try to make a clear distinction between the LDS Church and Mormonism. And Mormonism is a big, growing, diverse set of ideas that isn't limited necessarily to any one institution. And the LDS institution is one institution that harbors or facilitates Mormon's ideals. But for me, I couldn't see the difference between the two. And perhaps the most triggering of all my suicide ideation causes was in rejection from my LDS religious community. In a certain sense, I didn't choose to be LDS. I was born LDS. I was born in a religious home. And I'm a ninth generation Mormon, and Mormon pioneer blood flows in my veins. And this isn't something easily removed from one's identity. Mormonism is an essential and vital characteristic to my personal identity. It's as intimately bound to me as my sexual orientation or my gender. So asking me to choose between Mormonism and my sexual orientation is to strip me of essential aspects of my identity and my sense of self. So it's quite literally, in some ways, an existential death. If I can't be queer Mormon on earth, or even in the eternities, what I'm really hearing is there's no way for me to authentically exist here or anywhere else. In fact, in a very real way, it means when your identity isn't reflected in your community, it feels as if you don't exist at all. And furthermore, if there is being such a thing as being Mormon and queer on earth, it has been made very clear by ecclesiastical authorities that I can't be queer and sealed to all the people I love in the highest degree of celestial glory unless I make some serious changes. So it hurts deeply to be rejected from one's religious community on account of your sexual orientation. And this is something that's not exclusive to homosexuals. Bisexuals experience this too. And I don't even know if I have the words to adequately describe being rejected. Not just rejected, but like eternally rejected by those I love most on account of my gender and sexual orientation. So even if I choose to live a heterosexual monogamous marriage as a woman, I'm still barred from full participation when I'm in denied priesthood ordination in my LDS community. And it can sometimes feel that almost your original sin was being born a woman. Because in some ways you kind of feel like, oh, if I had just been born a man, it would be okay if I was sexually attracted to women. But that comes with its own problems too. Because if you weren't born, because you can't be attracted to men. So you have to be born man and woman for it to be okay. So every time I heard a general authority or a priesthood leader tell me they loved me, I cringed. I wanted to believe them. I desperately wanted to believe them so badly. But it felt false. For example, the words of Elder Bednar felt particularly false when he said, "What's more, I love you. The brethren among the general authorities say I love you." I'm reminded of the comment of President Boyd K. Packer made in speaking with those with same gender attraction. "We do not reject you. We cannot reject you. For you are sons and daughters of God. We will not reject you because we love you." Rhetorical letters became a common way of me processing my frustrations. And in one such rhetorical letter in my journal, I wrote, "Elder Bednar, if you love me, why does your love make me want to die? Why is it when I sit in your pews, I contemplate the most efficient and responsible way to end my life? instead of contemplating eternal life. If this is love, please stop loving me. Your love is killing me. I cannot imagine this is what love should feel like. If you do not reject me, why as a woman am I rejected the opportunity to baptize my children? Why do you deny same-sex families the blessings of eternal sealings? Why are children from some queer parents denied full fellowship, but others are? You lie. You have rejected us. Do not delude yourself into believing these actions and rhetoric are a product of love. It is disrespectful to the word love. I have felt love, genuine love, and it does not make me want to die. It makes me want to live. Your love is our death. It was a little aggressive, but that's how I am. There's nothing more dangerous than a benevolent abuser, and in that experience, my leaders were my abusers. My LDS community taught me that the words "I love you" came with a backhand. They kindly whispered, "We all have trials," but then backhand the side of my cheek. Just because God has allowed agency doesn't make it acceptable to abuse people in your religious community. Jesus said, turn the other cheek, and I do my best to follow that teaching. But at some times, a girl's got to move out of the line of fire. The prevailing messages from my LDS community was, you don't exist here, you don't exist in the next world, in this world or the next. The narrative preached by my religious community is theologically irresponsible, and it is killing people in my community. If there is a way for me to be authentically me in the eternities, or no way for me to be authentically me in the eternities, why wouldn't I try to end my life and pray that a merciful God would never resurrect me again? This is where I was at. Next bullet point is community. The prevailing theme of these concerns is lack of community, lack of understanding, and lack of recognition. Everywhere bisexual women turn, we are reminded we're born into a world that is often the case they don't want us, misrepresent us, ignore us, abuse us, and objectify us. If this is the narrative, it is naive to pretend that people exist independent of our community. So if we see ourselves through the eyes of a community, perception matters. It'd be easy to pretend to say, you know what, I'm fine on my own and I don't need to be recognized as a fully functioning, healthy, hopeful human being. But that's just not the case. We do need recognition from our communities. And that's not to say you need to stay in a harmful community. You need to make the right choice that's right for you. But it does take into account that community matters, and we need to be seen positively through our communities, through positive representation. The last point, though, is hope. So this is where my story diverges from the suicide statistics, because I've never attempted to take my own life, and so I can't tell you why one queer woman chooses to do that and why one queer woman chooses not to do that. But I can tell you, for me, these are the things that have been most helpful in my life. I have a family. I have a wonderful, loving, caring family. And the acceptance I have received from my family, particularly my husband, has been literally life-saving. Parents sometimes are hypothetically asked if they're willing to die for their children, but sometimes for queer parents, the question is, are you willing to live for your children? And for me, that is a conscious decision I make, to live for my children. It is my hope that there'll be time to still improve this world for a better future for my children. Another thing I have is I have friends. I have really good friends, and while sometimes they don't always understand what I'm experiencing, they are willing to listen. And they aren't always perfect, but neither am I. But one thing I have found helpful is to try and help meet people where they're at and set realistic expectations for myself. This is particularly true of my straight friends. So if you are a straight friend and your bi friend comes to you telling you things that you don't understand, it's perfectly okay to say, I don't understand, but I want to. Because that at least gives hope and that the door is open. But I have really wonderful friends that have been really affirming and really committed to being my friend, even beyond me coming out as bi. The other thing that has been really helpful for me is my activism. My story is my activism. My voice, my journal, my experience, my pen. And even more helpful has been the process of me going through and writing my book and going through all these interesting ideas to think about Mormonism in new and interesting ways that say, whoa, maybe I do fit in this narrative still. Maybe I don't fit technically in this institution with the rules that are already set in place, but theologically within Mormonism, I can fit. I can. The other thing is I believe in God, and I still believe in God. I'm not an enlightened atheist by any means. So sometimes, you know, my enlightened atheist friends like to poke fun at me. You know, how could you believe in a God who's an oppressor? And I'm like, because my God isn't an oppressor. I use my imagination. And rest assured, that's what everyone else is doing too. No one knows anything about God. So if your God isn't bringing you joy or happiness, give yourself permission to let your God give you joy and happiness. And once I gave myself that permission to let God be a part of my life on my terms and not on a external religious leader telling me what that was supposed to be like, that made a world of difference for me. And the last thing is I still have hope. And I think most suicide attempts happens for people who lose all hope that change is possible and perhaps have lost an inability to, or lost their tools to cope with present circumstances. But for me, I still have hope. I have activism. I have a lot of ideas about how things can change to the future. And hope is one important thing that I think keeps a lot of people living. Those are the problems. Now we get to talk about the hope.
Nick?
So that's why Blair's here. If you thought that was good, you should leave now because it's going to go downhill. No. I feel like the top of what I want to say, the first thing I want to say is I want to define what bisexual means to me because I see these conversations happen sometimes and it really drives me a little crazy. You probably know where this is going. I have been told that because I identify as bisexual that I don't like trans people. Yeah. That's a lie. My definition of bisexuality, which is not uncommon, but is not as common as I'd like, is fairly simple. Bi is two. I believe that I believe that bisexuality is I am attracted to both my own gender and genders that are not mine. It's still two options. It's just not the two options that people like to try to corner me into. So when I say bisexual, I am not. I have nothing wrong with
gender too.
See? So I just want to do that at the top. So I think that it's kind of interesting for me. So when I was in high school, because I was a nerd, shocking, my friends and I were kind of created a little comic book. We were all superheroes. Everyone was cool and had great powers. I was kind of lame because I had a lame imagination. So I was Mocha Man. I got my powers from drinking radioactive coffee, which was, you know, I was Mormon. But his little, like, tagline was, I'm Mocha Man, protector of all that is bi, .. racial, because I'm also biracial, right? So that was my, like, little, I'm bi, but not that one. I don't want to tell you that one yet, right? I feel like in some ways I've never not been out, but I've very much been in the closet, right? In my own mind, I've always been kind of out, but not really. And I think part of it for a while was not really knowing that bisexuality was like a thing that existed. I know when I was younger, you know, being attracted to other guys was not what I was supposed to do, it seemed, because I was supposed to like girls, but I also liked girls. But if you were a boy that liked boys, you were gay. But if you were a boy that liked girls, you were not. So I was both, neither, some other third category that no one's explained to me yet. At some point in my life, bisexual was a term that I learned and was like, ooh, that sounds right. Like that's the one. It's got great colors, too, which is also useful. Big fan. You know, I grew up Mormon. I grew up in the church. Growing up in the church, well, if you've done it, you know, there's really kind of one option for you. If you want to be a good Mormon, and for people who are listening to the recording, I'm making air quotes over on good, because that's you're straight. if you're Mormon. That's like that is the one option that is allowable. And that was not something that was going to work for me, which is fine because I was never really that believing. So I didn't mind so much. The church didn't really seem to want me very much. I also felt the church didn't really want me because I was not all white. So another thing, you know, I'm double bi. If I can think of a third one, I'm bi. Anyway, I'm tired. You know, for me, there's been a lot of... there's been a lot of struggle with actually finally coming out to people. And I think some of the first people I ever came out with, that I ever came out to were people in grad school, probably, which was a couple years ago. And it was just easy. I was in my early 30s, and I was in grad school with a bunch of people that were in their early, mid-20s, so I felt young. Not to say that if you're in your 30s, you're not young. I am still in my 30s. I feel young. But, you know, and it was just like the attitudes they have were different than mine. They're a solid decade younger than me, and we're just raised in a slightly different era. Not a whole lot, but just enough. So it was a lot easier to just kind of say things that were, you know, open to interpretation, that people had interpreted the way that I kind of hoped that they would. At some point, I needed to come out to my wife because I am married. I've actually had people ask me, why did you come out to your wife? Because I'm married, right? So no need to come out because I'm already in a relationship. I'm married, like, whatever. I think that was me, sorry. But to me, it's important because my wife is married to someone who's bisexual. She's not married to a straight guy. Like when I was younger, and bisexual wasn't a word I knew, if I have the option to make that a word that I use, that I use for myself, that people hear, then that's hopefully at least one more kid who's growing up not sure where they fit in because they're not gay, they're not straight, what are they? Well, here's this other word. You know, we talked about bi erasure before. Just back in October, one of my coworkers got married, and my boss and his wife were at the wedding. Afterwards, we went out to, you know, little after party thing, and this was right after I had publicly come out on Facebook. And my boss's wife said to me, "So why do you need to come out if you're married?" I was like, "Well, you're drunk, so I'm going to pretend that that's why you're asking me this." and she doesn't actually remember asking me this, apparently, but and she definitely asked me. And I said, "Because it's still who I am. If I married someone who was blind, would I not tell this blind person that I'm half black? I'm still half black, whether or not the person can see that, right?" To me, it's no different. I'm still bisexual, even if I appear or pass as straight, because I'm married to a woman. The notion of, you know, never being gay enough or straight enough, being biracial, I get it all over the place, right? You know, not white enough for white people, too white for black folks. I'm too passing as straight for a lot of gay people. I'm in a gay men's choir in the city of Baltimore. Great group of guys, right? I'm one of the straight ones because I'm married to a woman, right? Like, that's the assumption that they make because I'm not gay, obviously. I'm married to a woman, first of all, you could be gay and married to a woman, just going to throw that out there. But it's just the assumption that I'm straight. So that's been a little frustrating. And I wish it were, I wish I could say that, you know, the erasure and visibility problems were just coming from straight folks, but unfortunately that's not the case, which is very frustrating. But not to continue down the road of misery, sadness. You know, to me, I think that one of the great things right now, and this is, you know, a large part just, you know, it being 2019 and technology being a thing, and you know, just where we have, just how far we've come with things like gay marriage and just, you know, other social fights like that, is it's getting easier for folks, right? It's still not going to, it's still not, you know, just a, hey, guess what? I'm bi. And everyone's like, awesome. Great, great, great. And like nothing changes. There's always going to be folks, but it's certainly gotten easier. I mean, if I had tried to come out when I was in high school, like really tried to come out, it would have been really different. You know, this was still like the late 90s. It wasn't that long ago. But yeah, it was like 25 years. I know it's not, but it's had a reunion. I'm like, oh, anyways. So, you know, I mean, it, you know, nowadays I, you know, with social media, it's much easier to connect with people. And you know, even in like the post-Mormon spaces that I tend to inhabit, largely on social media, I just see more and more people who, often after they've transitioned out of the church, who have, you know, come to a realization that they are in fact not straight and are bisexual, what, you know, however they choose to identify. And I think I think it's nice that people find that they're able to do that now, because I don't think that would have been as easy to do even just a couple years ago before Facebook took over the universe. I think that it's particularly tough for, much like for parents of kids who are gay, I think that it's tough to be the parent of someone who is bisexual. I think, and maybe my mom who's sitting here will say something after I'm done talking on the microphone about this, but I'm no pressure. But you know, I feel like there's a certain amount of like hope still, that your kid will still be able to live that perfect Mormon dream, because they could still marry someone of the opposite gender, right? They could still marry someone.
Make the right choice.
They could do the right thing, quote unquote, right? And so I feel like that potentially leads to parents, you know, not trying to force that on their kid more, right? Like, it's okay. Okay, cool, you're bi, whatever. Go date this girl. Like, here's this girl. Like, it's this forced choice. Different situation, Blair. Different situation. I mean, but my parents also didn't try to set me up with anybody, so, mom. You know, so I just feel like that's just one of those things where it's even, you know, I don't have kids, so I'm making a bit of an assumption, but I don't think I'm that far off with just the fact that, you know, if you're living in this Mormon world and, you know, you have, as a parent, you know, have this dream for your kid, and for the bisexual person themselves, they often have that same thing themselves. I feel this way, but I know what the right thing is. The right thing is this. I can still do that thing. I can still marry a person of the opposite gender. I'm not going to say a woman, because then Blair's going to chime in. I can still do that, and I can still have the perfect Mormon life. And that's great, and that will work for some people. But part of the problem is that just because something works for someone doesn't mean it works for everybody. And this is, you know, you see this when you look at mixed orientation marriages. Some people make them work. A lot, most don't. You see this with people who are, you know, struggling with their faith, and they try to stay in the church, and they think they can make that work. And a lot of people manage to do that. A lot don't. Neither is like wrong, right? It's up to the individual what's going to work best for them. And I think that what's important is being able to make that information available, so that people understand that it's okay if path A is not going to be the one that works for you, because there is a path B and a path C and a path D. There's an infinite number of options for what is going to be the right path for you. And within the Mormon paradigm, that's tricky, because Mormonism is very, and you know, this is very regimented in that, you know, that this is your option. If it's not that, there's only one other option, and it's not a good one. It's a very all or nothing sort of situation. And that's not to say that I don't think that someone could, you know, find some way to navigate that staying in the church. It's not where I am, so it's hard for me to say that. But I just think that it's a good time now with kind of where we are with things. I mean, we have little buttons and everything. It's great. You know, pride celebrations are everywhere. And it's still not perfect, but I mean, you know, if we all look back on our lives, you know, past points, when have we been in a place, like when have we been at a time when we've been able to, you know, to have this sort of freedom? I think it's really all getting better, and it sounds cliche to say that, I feel, at this point, but, you know, I just think that it's just a matter of, you know, there's no right way. There's just an infinite number of options, right? So, you know, it's a little bit of trial and error, but we do this with hundreds of other aspects of our life all the time. But things like sexuality, things like religion, even politics, often are so much part of our identity, are so personal, are such a primary, you know, factor of our identity, that it seems like that's so much harder to kind of like suss out than something like, you know, where am I going to eat for dinner, or something that seems very like, you know, ordinary. But in reality, we all have that option, right? We all just have to kind of figure it out for ourselves and figure out like where we're going to go, how it's going to work out for us. And I think it's important to, you know, reach out to those, you know, to reach out to people, make those connections. I talk a lot to folks that are leaving the church or have left the church. And one of the struggles is always, you know, is it was like connecting with people, having a community. Whether you choose to stay in the church, whether you're out of the church, whether you've never been in the church. Community, community, community. Like, we are people. Human beings need community. That's just part of who we are. And you know, in certain geographical places, it's harder to find good community than others. So, again, the internet is great. Social media, you know, is ruining everything, but it's also really helpful sometimes. So, Blair's great. I'm just gonna say that. She does lots of writing. I think my primary thing is just that there's not, even within the Mormon paradigm, there doesn't have to be only one option. By definition, as a bisexual, I don't think there's only one option. I think that applies well beyond, you know, who I choose to love. So with that, I think I'd really just like to open questions, comments, either. I'm a big fan of discussion in general, so if someone asks a question and you feel like you have a good response, please chime in, because I think that at the end of the day, with the exception of Blair, who's really amazing and like knows everything, none of us are... I do this to all the people on my panels. No one's really an expert, right? We all have our... like, we all come from our own experiences and whatnot, and so we can all learn from one another. If anyone has any comments or questions...
I want to go first. I just wanted to say that, you know, I think part of the reason I have done what I've done with like my unabashed vulnerability on the internet is because there really wasn't a lot of bisexuals talking about these things. And I was like, hey, I'm struggling. And it was like screaming out into the social media digital abyss, like a radar gun, just like, is anybody else feeling this? Is anything else going on here? You know, just like going out, just looking for people and finding these groups. And even still, like, I'm still looking for resources and groups and all sorts of things like that to be like, is anybody else feeling these things? So we're all learning together, for sure. Okay, I can't wait to hear questions now.
I don't even know how to ask this, but I'm just going to throw it out there and hope that I got to admit, after hearing Blair yesterday, I was tempted to say that my reason for coming today was to learn how to be a strong voice for bi people as a straight white male, but see if you would throw anything at me. But so as a straight white male, I have been endowed by our social system with a certain unalienable privilege. How do I use that, especially within a church context, to be an ally, to help, without being the straight white savior?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you want to do it? I'll go first and then you can. Okay. No, you definitely can. Are you kidding? I want all the privileged people on my side. Absolutely. I want all that privilege. So one really important thing, I think, is to lift queer voices. Whenever you can lift a queer voice, go ahead and lift that queer voice and use your voice not necessarily as to smother the queer voice, but as a way of saying, hey, everyone, this person has something to say. Listen to what they're saying. Sometimes it does help to, which unfortunately I wish it weren't the case, but it does help to have someone backing you up who's in proper authority, using air quotes for the recording. Right, yes, eye roll for the recording. Because it does help to legitimize ourselves. So someone who does a lot of work in the community is Richard Osler, Papa Osler, and he does a lot of work in the LGBTQ community. And one really important thing that he does is that he does lift queer voices on his podcast. It's like, this is my position of privilege, and I'm going to use that to highlight queer people. Now, to the extent that hypothetically he didn't highlight queer voices, or he stopped listening to queer voices, and he just kept talking, well, that's the point that you've undermined your own goals of saying, I'm trying to help, because you're not helping anymore. So I think the important thing is to use your privilege to build the platform and share the queer voice to whatever you can, and support that voice to whatever you can authentically. I'm not saying you have to agree with everything a queer person says. I mean, my husband, he always has to do the dishes because that's what a good ally would do. But, you know.
I'm going to have to try that one. I guess my wife's a good ally then. So I think that step one is the fact that you thought about and asked the question. That's step one, right? Because a lot of people can't get even there, like, that far. There's a lot of folks do the, man, it would be great if the world wasn't dot, dot, dot. How, you know, why aren't these people, okay, so then what can you do? So step one, congratulations already. Everything Blair said, ditto. You know, I think that educating yourself, getting out, coming to things like this, talking to people who, you know, fit the identity of the folks you're going to help, you know, the LGBTQ plus community, whatever minority community, like whatever it is, and getting out and listening to them and asking questions like that. You know, like, what could I do for you that would help you guys out? Like, you know, like I want to, like I'm here to like boost you guys. What can I do to support you? I mean, that's great. Again, I wish more people did it. You see it all the time, whether it's, you know, with the LGBT stuff or, you know, racial minorities. You see a lot of these events happen, and it's a lot of white folks saying what black people or what, you know, minorities need or want. And then you see those same communities, like the same minority community saying, actually, so why didn't you just go to talk to them first? You know? So
I'm going to ask the Mormon church leader question, and I want to be, I don't know that it matters, but I want to be clear. I think I know the half of the answer, and this is a setup. Okay. So the Mormon church leader says, we've now become pretty clear that we're concerned about behavior and not about orientation. So if you're coming out, if you're identifying yourself, in now that we're pretty clear about this, I'm trying to sort of channel this, but now that we're pretty clear about this, if you're coming out, the only reason I can imagine for you coming out is that you are telling me you've seen someone you want to hook up with who's of the same gender, you're announcing to me that you're now going to act in the way that we've said you shouldn't act. What other possible reason is there for you to even be talking about this? Okay.
So I have two things to say. The first one is cynical. Shocking for me, if you know me. The idea that the church believes currently that action is the part, is the troubling part. That might be true today, but we all know that changes tomorrow. So who knows? Cynicism ending. Okay. So other answer. For me, it's because a church leader would think that was a thing. That's why I do it. That's why I would come out. That's why I would do it. Because I can come out and I can be, monogamous with my wife and still be bisexual. It doesn't, just because you're bisexual doesn't mean that you are all these, all these other things necessarily, right? So we need more and more people who identify as bisexual, identify as queer, who don't fit the stereotype beliefs that people have, to show that that's not what we are. It's the same reason that they're trying to get more and more women to work in tech, and that they want more people of color to go into businesses and law, because how else do you ever break the stereotypes that exist by unless you start disproving those ideas?
So part of the reason for me was I was perfectly, I shouldn't say perfectly content, but I was relatively content in the closet, and just because I am fairly introverted, and I was happy just with my husband knowing and my sister knowing and my besties knowing, and I didn't need to say a dang thing to anyone else. Totally just that's fine. You don't need to know me. You don't need to know anything about my business, because I'm particularly untrusting of people in the first place. So for me, it wasn't a big deal to come out until it was. And do you know why it was a big deal? The November policy. I had no reason to come out of the closet until the November policy. And once that policy was announced, my husband and I sat down and had a conversation with our children. And we basically talked about, look, mommy's going to be a lot more open about the fact that she likes men and women and things like that. Because if someone puts a policy in place saying that parents in homosexual relationships can't, but bisexual parents in heterosexual relationships can get their children baptized, that I felt my community needed to know, hey, there's still queer people here baptizing their kids. You can't get rid of all of us. So if they wanted me to be in the closet, they should have left well enough alone, but they didn't. And so they made their own worst nightmare. I am what they made me. So at the end, I know that's the mama dragon mantra too. It's if you raise a mother to take care of her child, and that is her divine calling and destiny, and then the church tries to put a wedge in that, you're going to get your hand bit. So there's just nothing good that's going to come out of that. So for me, there was definitely a need to come out, just like what Nick is saying, to basically say, look, we're here, we're queer, and even though you're trying to make policies to get us out, some of us are still very much still here in the pews. With that also, I think there is certain amount of legitimacy as far as you want people to know you and know who you are, and even if you're never going to, have a relationship with someone of the same gender, or you're strictly committed in your monogamous relationship, that doesn't mean you don't want the important people in your life to know something about you. That's why I started telling my friends and family, just because I wanted them to know me better. I wanted them to know my favorite color. I want them to know things about me, my favorite food and things like that. And it was one of those things. It wasn't needed to be public until it was needed to be made public. And the harder they pushed, gosh darn it, I'm going to put that on a sign, and I'm going to go stand on the corner of the conference center. I'm going to give people hugs. I'm going to smile real big. You want passive aggressive? I will give you passive aggressive. My friend. Anyway, I don't know where that came from. Next question.
Thank you. Can I start by thanking you for this panel?
And also thanking you for the opportunity to make this a bit more of a discussion, because I don't have a question, but I do have a suggestion. And it's addressing the question of what can people in privilege do. And I think lifting queer voices is an amazing answer and a valuable answer. And I also think not making assumptions, because many queer voices are in the closet and they might be screaming from the closet, but you can't hear them if the closet's been bricked over, so to speak. And I'll say that's true of I attended BYU, and even progressive professors who had the best intentions and wanted to have conversations about what it meant to be queer in the church and wanted to have put forth progressive solutions to what it meant to be queer in the church would speak to a classroom of people and assume that everyone in that classroom was straight. And it happens at church all the time too, in Sunday schools, and even people who are very well-intentioned will make the assumptions that everyone in that room is straight. And that can be really hurtful, particularly because coming out of the closet, as you addressed, is not a one-time event. You have to do it over and over and over again. And it helps when the assumptions of heterosexuality aren't being constantly made.
I'm so glad you brought that up. Speak as if there's always a queer person in the room. And the odds are there probably is one, and whether you know it or not. Not all of them are as loud as me, so.
Well, thank you for doing your panel, and I'm interested in your book, Blair. We have a kid, I think you heard, who's non-binary, gender, and how they said that their existence subverts the plan of salvation. I was wondering if that was kind of what you were feeling. Like, how would you compare yourself to that? And also, does your book have, like, a workaround? I mean, I'm not actually personally invested in making it all work with the plan of salvation the way I think, but if you do, I'm just sort of, can you give us a spoiler?
Oh my gosh. I'm like, let me start with page 200 and go from there. No, that's why I wrote the whole book, because I really, it's funny. I can't see Mormon theology in any other way but queer affirming now, because I've become so entrenched in looking at the narrative through a totally different lens, because once I divorced the idea of this is the authority telling me how things should be, as opposed to I have my own thoughts about our theology and how things should be interpreted. So, yeah, definitely. Little teasers about the book. So the book is definitely about the full spectrum of LGBT inclusive. So we have non-binary, trans, asexual, the whole gamut. It's meant to be totally inclusive of the whole alphabet soup. To your question specifically, I don't even know where to start. It makes me so gleeful. I'm just so happy. So one of the really interesting places of opportunity in Mormonism is we have the doctrine of theosis, and that we all eventually get to become gods. So our typical archetype is this idea that we have a heavenly mother who doesn't say or do much other than have children, and then we have a heavenly father who does everything and gets all the glory, right? But this does open up some doors, though, because we are implicitly polytheist. And if there's more than one God, if there's more than two gods, and if it's gods within gods and worlds without ends and all sorts of things, and the potential of the amounts of gods and the way we see ourselves in the image of God opens up really big. And we can start to see ourselves beyond, like women have had to do this in a lot of ways. Like, I didn't see myself in the Heavenly Father archetype of God. I'm like, that's not the God I'm going to be. I'm not going to be that God. I didn't even see the archetype in Heavenly Mother for me personally, because I more identify with a non-binary kind of gender, but I'm queer. But once I started to realize that if Mormonism in its theology is polytheistic, and we have all have the opportunity to become gods, the image of God is way more diverse than what we're thinking. The image of God is everyone. We are all the image of God. And once you start to open up those doors, you can get into more interesting places. So for example, in the plan of salvation, reductively, it would be, men and women getting together to make lots of babies eternally to populate things. But when we start to take a look about how families are on Earth, that's not really how families are on Earth. And we've been told that, you know, celestial glory, celestial kingdoms right here on Earth. And what exists now will exist later. And so if what families are now
are also going to exist later within the theological narrative. So, for example, if we have families who can adopt children and be sealed to those children in temples and be with them forever, why can't we have adopted parents in the eternities forever? Why does it always have to be strictly about biological gestation? Why can't a same-sex couple adopt and be adoptive eternal parents forever and ever? It's happening right here, right now. It's already happening in the temple. I don't see any difference why it couldn't be in the next. I mean, the temple is the example, the archetype. And so if we can have adoptive families there, why can't that include gay adoptive families? There's really not a good reason for it. And then on top of that, like if you get into the reproductive technologies, oh my gosh, this is good. Am I boring you yet? I'm so excited. So if you take a look at reproductive technologies and where we're going with how we do gestate new life and new human beings. So we have IVF, and people born in IVF aren't born from typical, you know, heterosexual vaginal penile penetration. You know, they're made in a petri dish and inserted into a uterus for gestation. But it even says in the church handbook that children made from IVF are born in the covenant. So we have these precedences for technological means of gestating human beings being of the covenant. So if we take that one step further with technological advancements happening, like I guarantee you, like mark my words, I'm totally making a prediction right now, even though it's not true. But what I will say is I guarantee you it's only a matter of time until two women can have their own biological offspring. It will be harder for men, for obviously cis men, for plumbing reasons, but biologically women will be able to reproduce their own biological female offspring. That'll be the first step. It'll be much harder for cis men. But right now, even on the table that is happening, is children being born from parents of three biological parents. So what happens is you have the egg, and inside is the mitochondria. And so if the mom has a mitochondrial disorder, they can take the mitochondria out of her egg, take an egg donor, insert another woman's mitochondria into the egg, and then insert, you know, dad's sperm, whatever. And then you have the sperm, mitochondria, and egg, basically shell, membrane, whatever, of three people gestating into another person, and that person comes out. This has actually happened. This offspring has the DNA of two mothers and a father. Yes, and the father. So it's literally a three-parent offspring. So when we start to look at the direction of reproductive technologies and the way people are going to be gestated and created, the fact that we're like, no, but in heaven, it's only going to be vaginal penile penetration. And it's like, that's just not life on earth. So if the same thing exists in this world and the next and everything, well, it's just going to keep getting queerer, folks, okay? Like, you can't unqueer this narrative once you start moving into different places. Anyway, those are just some teasers, but you have to read the book. I know, it's going to be amazing. Exactly.
And then how was Eve created?
Well, Eve was obviously created from three men, because duh. You know, so exactly. So like it, hypothetically, the DNA, the rib of one man created this female, and it took like, male gods to go ahead and do this. And so we have a really queer theology that, and plus when you take into account of polygamy and plurality, and also like, I don't know why we're not like this hippie religion full of plural love and like queer people and things like that. But you know, anyway, it's going to be awesome. Like if you want the book sooner, everyone go email Steve Evans and tell him I want Blair's book sooner.
Well, I'm just going as fast as I can here, but kind of spinning around because there are a lot of concepts that I've trying to adapt to. When I was a kid, there weren't any gay people. Everybody was straight. Mm-hmm. And then I got through high school and found out that a lot of my friends were gay. I just didn't know, that sort of thing. And then I got one nephew whose mother denied that he was gay. He came out to her, but she denied it right up until she went to the wedding. So they've kind of come around. I've got another nephew who's obviously gay, but nobody is talking about it. Nobody admits it. So I think there are a lot of people who are, you know, working with that kind of thing. And then I need a lot of definitions, because you just distinguish between gender and orientation. I haven't quite figured that out yet. But anyway, it's interesting and evolving and developing, and the idea of queer gods is, you know, something I'm still working with. But a couple of years ago here at Sunstone, there was a woman from Ogden who was working with homeless kids. She had 350 homeless kids, most of whom were homeless because they had been kicked out by their parents. And I think we're still working with that. So, interesting. I appreciate the panel, and I'm just trying to catch up.
No, I'm so happy you're here. I will say something about separating gender and sexual orientation, because it is a little bit confusing the way we talk about it, and even in academia too. So people try to separate the idea that gender identity is different than sexual orientation. And I think it's a good distinction, but it's not always a clear distinction, and here's why. So someone's gender identity is just how they feel about themselves and how they are experiencing their own gender. Sexual orientation is how they feel about other people and their desire for other people. But it's not entirely independent, though, because sexual orientation is dependent upon gender identity, right? So it wouldn't make sense for a woman to call herself a lesbian if it wasn't predicated upon a gender identity. So gender identity in some ways comes first, at the very least, on a terminology level, right? So there's no such thing as like a bisexual if there's no such thing as multiple genders. We have to have multiple genders in order for bisexuality to exist. So it is a complicated relationship. So it's totally okay if you're not like totally on board with it yet. Did you want to say something to that? Sorry.
No, I think you're good. Okay.
Yeah. So our kid who is non-binary gender identifies as neither one or both and or kind of like, when people ask, so what's your sexual orientation, then that becomes like, well, it's common. Yeah, right. Because, he's like, well, first you have to have are you attracted to the opposite sex? And then if you are, does that make you hetero? Yeah, if you're neither gender, then what is your sexual orientation?
Right, and this is so much so why I also identify with queer. Because I feel like, look, I like what I like when I like it. I identify how I like, and I don't necessarily need to put that into any type of thing. I like all different types of bodies. I feel both masculine and feminine at certain times in my life. That has changed a lot in my life as well. I've had a lot of surgeries and things done to whatever with my body. So I really embrace the term queer for that reason, to describe my sexual orientation and gender identity. Because at the same time, too, this idea of there also has been some play with terminology that's independent of your identity. So a lesbian would be a woman attracted to a woman, right? But like, if I didn't want to disclose my gender identity and I wanted to say I was attracted to women, the word would be gynophiliac. For men, it would be androphiliac. But these terms aren't catching on, probably because, yeah, they work. They work. Yeah, exactly. I'm a gynophiliac, and my husband loves it now. He's like, oh yeah, for sure, total gynophiliac. I'm like, oh, it sounds creepy when you say it. Don't do that, hon. He's like, I'm just trying to be accurate. I'm like, okay. But yeah, it is tricky. So we're coming up with new terms all the time to try and deal with this. And so it's okay if sometimes the terms don't always fit, because people are still figuring it out.
One thing I also wanted to say, going back to definitions and terms, is I think that there's this perception, partly, again, because bi folks tend to be kind of, you know, erased and invisible, that there's not a lot of us. And I think part of that is because a lot of us pass as something different. And I think some of it is because there's a lack of clarity on even folks that might identify as bi if they understood that bi is a lot bigger of a window than they might think. Right? To me, on one end of the spectrum, you have being homosexual. On the other end of the spectrum is heterosexual, on the spectrum of, you know, same gender attraction versus opposite gender attraction. Everyone in the middle is bisexual. Everybody else, right? It's actually a really big spectrum. But what ends up happening is you have people that might be, mostly homosexual. They might be kind of attracted to women, but they've never, it's never been anything they pursued. They feel far more comfortable, with another man if they're, if they're a man. So they choose to identify as gay. There's nothing wrong with that, right? But the spectrum of bisexuality is much larger, in my mind, than I think a lot of people give it credit for. I think there's a lot of assumptions that, you're in the middle, you like 50-50, men, women, not the case. And not even, you don't even stay on the same point of the spectrum forever anyways. As Blair mentioned earlier with, fluidity, people go back and forth. So with that, I just think there's a lot more. But what was that? Who knows? The future will tell. The future. Yeah. I think that does another disservice just with the idea that, that bisexuality is just this like other smaller little subset of the larger, it's a very large spectrum if we choose to make it look like that.
So we have 2 minutes left. Are there closing remarks that either one of you want to make? I noticed there's a couple of...
No, we'll get the question.
Okay. So 2 minutes. So if we could just be short, we have two people that would like to speak.
Just quickly, Blair, if I'm understanding you correctly, you guys, your child could say something like, rather than defining their attraction in terms of who they are, they could say, I like men, I like women, rather than saying I'm gay or I'm lesbian or sometimes maybe even I don't like either or I like both. Is that, am I getting it?
Yes.
We have a very queer family. But yeah, so like today I'm asexual and then tomorrow I'm bi and then today I'm gynophiliac or whatever.
Yeah. It's fluid.
Yeah. Last one. Real quick.
So I really like queer actually as a term. But these are questions about where we are in society, where we are in terms of what's kind of how people talk. It still feels like if I, as a white, cis male, mm-hmm. use queer, there's some kind of, I have to have a whole paragraph before I could use the word and not get a kind of a side glance. That's one. The second is thinking about my children when they were teens. Mostly I'm thinking about my children when they were teens. I'm really... hesitant about asking or allowing even a clear identification. We had several conversations, but it felt like, and looking back, it feels like I don't want you to say you're gay. I don't want you to say you're bi. I don't want you to settle yet. I mean, everybody I know who's clear in their 20s and 30s tells me they were really clear about it when they were 9. But thinking about my teens, I didn't want them to identify very clearly. Yeah, and I mean, am I just wrong in that?
So to your first point about the word queer, so partly generational. Partly intent, right? You can say a lot of things to a lot of people if you say them the right way. There's always a big part of knowing your audience that always helps. But I mean, I think that's one that's kind of generational, and I think it's becoming less of a problematic word because there has been a lot of reclamation of it. We've seen happen with other words in the space. To your second point, I think that the most important thing, and again, I'm not a parent, but thinking about my own family, I never felt from my parents' end that there was anything wrong with wherever I would end up, right? And so I think the important part is less about not wanting to, not wanting your child to identify, but making it clear that it's okay if they do or don't, right? And it's really more that than anything else. Because I think that you end up with the most problems when a kid feels that they have to pick a thing when a thing doesn't make sense to them, or that they are not supposed to pick a thing when they feel that they know. But that's just me.
Yeah.
Just either way, if they want to identify, then that's fine, and understand it could change later.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think it can be just as empowering to claim an identity as to reject an identity or to not claim an identity. So, again, it's not necessarily, oh, I don't want you to identify as something. And I think that comes from the idea that it has to be a fixed position, and it doesn't have to be a fixed position. Think about it within a faith transition. You believed something before, and those things changed. When you believed those things before, you believed them with sincerity. That was really where you were at. But guess what? Things change. And now you believe this right now with sincerity. And guess what? In the future, you're going to believe something different with sincerity. So it's very similar with gender and sexual orientation too. You can sincerely be something and choose something without having to be committed to it for the rest of your life. But most people aren't accustomed to thinking about gender and sexual orientation as something other than fixed, of something that's totally innate, as something that, and not to say it's not innate, but static. Is what I'm trying to get across. And so I really think we need to embrace the authenticity of fluidity. Fluidity doesn't mean I'm confused. I'm not confused at all. I know exactly how I feel and exactly what I want. It just changes. And that's okay too. And it's very sincere and it's very authentic. At the same time, it can be, you know, I am a parent too. I don't want my kids to commit to something that they're going to regret later. So I like to keep my door open and my options open and say, you don't have to decide anything now. But if you do decide something now, I'm going to back you up on that too. So it's giving them the space to be able to decide or not decide to commit or not to commit, and recognizing that these aren't set in stone forever. Marriage is probably a little different, though, but orientation is not.
So behalf of Sunstone, we want to thank Blair and Nick for sharing their stories, and each of you for the respectful dialogue that you've engaged in. Thank you.